dead lay unburied. Each man recognized a friend among them and shuddered with grief and horror. Thucydides, describing the Athenians as they retreated from their defeat at the siege of Syracuse. Hello and welcome to the Western Traditions Podcast. This is the 26th episode of The Greek Sun, a series of podcasts about the history of ancient Greece. By now, we have reached the Peace of Nicias, a period of relative peace between Athens and her allies and the Spartans and their allies in the Peloponnesus and elsewhere. Now, before I describe how the Greeks returned to this conflict, let me remind you to visit the website at western-traditions.org. That's western-traditions.org, where you can find all the episodes of this podcast. You can also find the Western Traditions podcast on Spotify, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, YouTube, and many other platforms. Wherever you listen, please remember to like, share, comment, and subscribe. On my website, western-traditions.org, you can also buy Western Traditions merchandise or directly support my work through the PayPal or Patreon options. And now, let's return to the Peloponnesian War during the Peace of Nicias, which lasted only long enough to help the combatants forget the horrors of war and once again deem the excitement of conflict better than the restlessness of inaction. What moved the Greeks to return to war? After 10 years of gruesome combat, 10 years of massacres, betrayals, horrific defeats, and costly victories, and given the opportunity for peace, what could possibly make them want to renew that conflict? We could try to find the causes, try to explain how they came to choose a path that led back to war, but maybe the easiest answer is also the most accurate, that strife was in their character. We have already seen, and God forgive me, I have admired it all, we have already seen how the Athenians were so driven, so energetic, and so ambitious. Perhaps it was just not in them to sit idly in peace when there was the chance to gain an advantage. They certainly did not endure the peace well. Right from the start, each side, really, the Spartans as well, maneuvered and schemed, complicating and endangering the fragile quiet in what turned out not to be not an end to conflict, but merely the calm at the eye of the storm. We might better call the Peace of Nicias a Cold War. Anyone who lived through the latter half of the 20th century will remember that the Soviet Union and the West, from 1945 to 1991, were really engaged in a long, low-intensity conflict, even though the world was technically at peace. They engaged in proxy wars in Korea and Vietnam and Afghanistan and spied on and intrigued against one another everywhere that they made contact. Just so with the Greeks after the Peace of Nicias, which began in 421 BC. Each side saw failures of cooperation with the other. Towns designated for return were held onto. In one case, the Spartans returned a city to Athenian control only after they had burnt it to the ground. It even affected the Olympic Games, which should sound familiar to anyone who has watched how the Games have been politicized by one global faction or another over the last century. Normally, among the ancient Greeks, a truce was declared before each Olympics in order to allow each participating city-state to safely attend the Games. But the Spartans were banned from the Olympics of 420 BC for making military maneuvers after the truce had already begun. Also, remember that Sparta had officially allied with Athens in order to enable this peace. This did not sit well with many longtime Spartan allies, such as Corinth, who immediately started scheming with other members of the Peloponnesian alliance to form a new defensive league of city-states, excluding both Sparta and Athens. This endeavor failed to form a new alliance, though, and the so-called peace continued on, unsteadily, for a total of 6 years and 10 months, before hostilities opened again. The Athenian invasion of Sicily in 415 BC, which brought all the major Greek city-states into conflict once again, was probably the epic moment of the war, the true turning point which marked the beginning of the end of Athenian hegemony. But before I get into that, I should tell you a little bit about one of the most memorable figures of the Peloponnesian War, a man named Alcibiades. Alcibiades was an Alcmenid, a member of that famous and influential family which had been at the center of every major Athenian struggle for centuries now. He was one of several people who saw the war as their chance to step forward in society, as the members of the political old guard were either killed in combat, voted out of office, or banished. In Sparta, the kings Agis and Plastoanax had come forward to rule over a Sparta that had changed and was continuing to change, as we shall see, in terms of culture and in ethnic makeup. In Athens, Pericles and Cleon were both dead now, and in their place, in terms of public acclaim anyway, if not exactly in terms of political power, two men had come forward to take the reins of Athenian society. Nicias had achieved some fame as a general and had orchestrated the peace aptly named after him. His political rival was the young newcomer Alcibiades. Alcibiades was born sometime around 450 BC, thus the war had started when he was just a teenager. Already by the time of the peace, when he would have not yet turned 30, he had been involved in combat multiple times and had led troops on the field. When still in his teens, at the Battle of Potidaea, Alcibiades had been saved from injury or even death during combat by an older man named Socrates, who would later go on to become one of the most recognized philosophers of all time. In turn, Alcibiades had later shielded Socrates' retreat at the Battle of Delium in 424 BC. When we come to the episodes on Socrates in the future, I will get more into the relationship between these two famous men of Athens. But this association with famous names bears mentioning now, because Alcibiades was more than just a soldier, more than even just a general, to which rank he came during the time of the peace. Alcibiades, from an early age, was intent on being a mover and a shaker in the Athenian political world. Indeed, as some of his detractors suspected, he probably desired more than anything to be the mover and shaker, to bring an end to over a century of democracy in Athens and to become its sole master. What was he like, this ambitious man, this aspiring tyrant? He was irresistible, actually. Even his enemies liked him. When given the opportunity to be in the same room with him, to enjoy his company, they couldn't resist. They could admire his wit and his charm, even while they recognized that he was a most dangerous friend and someone devoted only to his own well-being. Physically, Alcibiades was recognized as a beautiful man, and always had been, from earliest youth until his middle years. Now, he spoke with a lisp, but he did not let his speech impediment deter him in any way. In fact, Plutarch describes him as desiring to be known for eloquence more than anything else, and he was a powerful public speaker. Alcibiades really was the kind of man who had had everything given to him at birth. He was wealthy, he was physically beautiful, and he was born into the aristocracy. But truthfully, he was also valiant, and to his credit, he was not afraid to risk his skin in any of his adventures. Perhaps the most disturbing quality about Alcibiades was his extreme selfishness and egotism. Here is just one story that exemplifies his self-serving nature. A friend of his, by the name of Anytus, invited Alcibiades to come to his house for a party. Alcibiades refused the invitation and stayed at his own house that evening, drinking with some other companions. Once they were all good and drunk, Alcibiades led these companions over to the house of Anytus. Standing in the doorway and seeing all the gold and silver cups on the tables at this party, Alcibiades ordered his drunken companions to carry off half of them and bring the cups back to his own home, and they carried on the festivities there with Anytus's fancy tableware. The party guests at Aeneas's house were naturally upset by this marauding, but Aeneas assured all of them, that Alcibiades had actually been quite conscientious, in fact, since he could have taken everything, but he only took half. Alcibiades had this power over people that many of his acquaintances fawned over him and tolerated his worst behavior. Though he was married, Alcibiades openly saw a variety of courtesans, that's a fancy word for prostitute, on a steady basis. His wife eventually couldn't accept any more of this disrespect and she left him, but he showed no remorse at all and carried on with his life. When his wife did finally go to court to divorce him, though, Alcibiades appeared just as she arrived to start the proceedings, and he grabbed her up into his arms and carried her home. Now, what Alcibiades desired more than anything, perhaps, was to be the center of attention. All his life, there was a certain boyishness about him in the way he tried to show off. Alcibiades, for instance, had a famously beautiful large dog which everyone admired. One day, he cut off the dog's tail. When all of his friends and acquaintances were loudly appalled at this, he explained himself thus: "I wanted all Athens to talk about this, so that they wouldn't say something worse about me." Now, as I have said, he had fought in several battles throughout the long war. When Nicias finally negotiated a real peace with Sparta, Alcibiades was not entirely happy about it. Perhaps he simply didn't want peace, but perhaps he also simply didn't like the possibility that Nicias would gain fame for this political coup. Now, after peace had already been declared, Alcibiades intercepted ambassadors from Lacedaemon who came to Athens to address certain matters regarding this new alliance. These ambassadors told Alcibiades that they had come with full powers to make terms with Athens. He cautioned the men that the Athenian assembly, if they knew what power the men had, would then press them hard to surrender too much in the negotiations. Instead, Alcibiades advised them, they should focus initially on minor matters and not claim any significant powers of negotiation. Alcibiades told the ambassadors that he would then stand in the assembly and come to their aid. And so, when the men stood before the assembly of the Athenians the next day, Alcibiades immediately came to his feet and demanded to know with what powers the ambassadors from Lacedaemon had come. Now, playing along with his ruse, the visitors from Sparta replied that they were not plenipotentiaries, that is, they were not men with full powers to negotiate. Alcibiades then loudly berated the men as deceivers, who had come to Athens without even the required capacity to accomplish anything, and he insisted to the assembly that these men were just another insincere embassy from their enemies in Sparta. In short, he made the peace and the work of Nicias look shoddy in the public eye. This political show led to Alcibiades being declared a general and given authority to raise forces, to ally with certain Peloponnesians, and to invade that peninsula in 418 BC. This was not technically a declaration of war on Sparta, who was their ally, but only an intervention in Argos, one of Sparta's neighbors. Here, after a series of battles, Sparta was eventually victorious over the rebellious Argives and over Alcibiades, who had to retreat with his forces before the Spartan military response, which many saw as a reversal of the Spartan humiliation at Pylos several years before. Somehow, even under these conditions, though, the Peace of Nicias was still observed for a few more years, even though Spartan and Athenian forces had briefly met in combat. It is worth noting that the victorious Spartan forces in these battles were now composed not only of the famous Spartan Corps of Knights, but there was also a unit known as Brasidas's Veterans, the men who had marched to Thrace and warred with that fallen Spartan hero years before. As well, there were now also freed Helots fighting in the Spartan front lines. War always brings unexpected cultural change. But sometimes war brings more than change. It also brings extinction. In the summer of 416 BC, after 5 years of peace, the Athenians landed forces on the island of Melos, just off the coast of Anatolia. Now, the settlement of Melos was founded by colonists from Lacedaemon, perhaps as much as 700 years before this, and was therefore associated by both culture and blood to the Spartans. The island had maintained its neutrality throughout the long years, preferring neither side in the Greek conflict. The Athenians arrived at the island with almost 40 ships and more than 3,000 total troops, including allies. After disembarking from their ships, the Athenians sent envoys to the capital city to negotiate a surrender. When the Melians rebuffed their aggression, the Athenians insisted that they had a right to their empire because, quote, "we overthrew the Mede," unquote. More than 60 years had passed since the Persian War, and the Athenians were still playing that card. The Melians would not surrender, and hostilities commenced. For a time, the Melians made several small victories against the Athenian besiegers, which only embarrassed and enraged the quote-unquote overthrowers of the Mede. By winter, sufficient reinforcements, though, had arrived from Athens, and the Melians knew that, however brave they might be, however many tactical victories they might achieve, they could not hold out much longer. Anyway, they were starving by then, so the city leaders surrendered unconditionally and let the Athenians in. All the adult men of the city were immediately executed, and all the women and children were sold into slavery. 500 colonists were brought in from Athens to take possession of the island. Now the Athenians had overthrown the Mede and the people of Melos. Yet the war had not really started up again, not officially. That would change in 415 BC. That year, around the time of the Melian massacre, the Athenians made the initial decision to plan an invasion of Sicily. They were invited to this campaign by the city of Egesta, which was an Ionian colony on an island inhabited by a wide variety of peoples, by Phoenicians, by native Sicels, as they were called, and by Greeks of both Ionian and Dorian backgrounds, as well as other ethnic groups. The Egestans were in an ongoing conflict with Syracuse, which was founded long ago, according to legend, by a Heraclid, or a descendant of Heracles, from Corinth. The Syracusans, therefore, were Dorian Greeks in terms of both culture and blood, and now they were the antagonists in a long struggle with Ionian colonies and allies on the island. The representative from Egesta to Athens also reminded the Athenians that Syracuse was a Dorian city and that if eventually successful against the other Ionian settlements, they could be expected to send future military aid to Sparta against Athens. Most importantly, though, Egesta even offered to pay for the entire undertaking. Everyone knew that this would be a massive ordeal, much bigger than the flanking maneuver they had accomplished earlier in the war that had led to the small but significant victory over the Spartans at Pylos. Nicias, however, worried that his fellow Athenians did not understand just how much was being asked of them. Thucydides himself, the historian of the war, states that, for one, the assembly was actually really ignorant of the size of Sicily. I mean, if you look at a map of the Mediterranean now, you can see that Sicily is not just bigger than Sparta, but bigger than the entire Peloponnesian Peninsula. And it's also very far away, across hundreds of miles of open sea. And now the Athenians were contemplating not just visiting the island, but conquering it and occupying it with an army. Nicias spoke in the assembly as the invasion was being contemplated, and he had this to say about the endeavor. "You will leave enemies behind you here," he said, "in order to go far away and bring more back with you." And he also recognized the hand of his new rival, Alcibiades, in all this. He urged his fellow council members not to listen to the brash youth, nor to fear being called cowards simply for refusing to vote for more war, when they were presently enjoying the comforts of peace. But the assembly voted for war, and no one was a greater cheerleader for the invasion than Alcibiades. There were as well, according to Thucydides, many up-and-coming young men who had not fought in the first part of the war and who now saw an opportunity for glory and reward. Many such men moved the public sentiment in favor of the war. Perhaps Alcibiades summed up the pro-invasion argument best when he said essentially that it was against Athenian nature to sit idly in peace, that it was their true nature to be ambitious to the point of recklessness, and that they would be ruined quicker and more disastrously through inactivity. Nicias, though, tried one more time to scare the Athenians out of this idea. He recommended, if they were going to do it anyway, that they take an enormous number of ships in order to transport the massive amounts of troops and cavalry required, and to provide naval protection for both the land forces and the supply chain, which would have to bring an enormous amount of supplies with it. Nicias hoped that his listeners would realize that this undertaking would strip Athens of men and ships and leave it vulnerable to Spartan assault. But it was all to no avail. The assembly voted overwhelmingly in favor of the expedition. Nevertheless, both Nicias and Alcibiades were sent as generals together on the expedition, along with a third man named Lamachus. Recall that Athens always put multiple men in charge of their military operations, usually using some kind of rotating command schedule. But Alcibiades embarked on the expedition somewhat hamstrung. After the decision to invade Sicily passed in the assembly, someone disfigured and defaced a number of statues of the gods in the city. Rumors swirled among the public, blaming Alcibiades and/or his companions for this crime. Furthermore, the rumors also said that Alcibiades had been mimicking and mocking the mystery rituals, those used in the worship of Demeter and Persephone at Eleusis, during his regular drunken debauches with his friends. Worse, even darker gossip spread that this was all part of an attempt to undermine the democracy and replace it with an oligarchy or a tyranny. The young general boldly denied the charges leveled against him and insisted on being tried for these crimes immediately before leaving. He should be put to death, Alcibiades said, if the heinous charges were true. He did not want to go to Sicily while distracted by a future trial. But his accusers worried that if they tried him now, the army, which adored Alcibiades, would declare their loyalty for him and accomplish the overthrow of the government. So he was sent on his way to Sicily, knowing that at some point during operations, he would be called back to undergo a trial in Athens. Thucydides reports that the armada which sailed for Sicily was by far, and I quote here, the most costly and splendid Hellenic force that had ever been sent out by a single city at that time. He only reports a total of 100 ships at the start of the journey, but these were augmented during the cruise by more than 30 allied ships and another 30 supply ships full of grain and beasts of burden and bakers and carpenters and stonemasons and all their tools. And there were numerous smaller boats to support the fleet as well. So truly, this was a grand armada crossing the sea to invade a large island full of the finest troops Athens had to offer and full of the ambitions of the entire populace. The fleet paused at Rhegium, at the toe of the boot of Italy, and sent three ships ahead to investigate whether the Egestans had the money ready to pay for the invasion. The three ships returned with bad news. The Egestans only had 30 talents available to pay for the fleet. This was far less than what the Athenians had imagined after their ambassadors had been shown so much treasure when the Egestans first courted them. It turned out that the Egestans, when they had first asked for help, had shown their entire treasury to the Athenian envoys who came to hear their plea, but they had shown the treasury as if it were only a part of the total funds available, and had simply allowed the Athenian envoys to deceive themselves. And now the Athenians were here in Sicily with three generals and a huge fleet and an army, which the Egestans were not prepared to fund. Now, at this point, Nicias suggested that they simply make a show of force and might, and that then they sail home with all of Athens' most important resources, their ships and their men, intact, and forget about this endeavor. Alcibiades, on the other hand, wanted to seduce more of the local cities into an alliance so that they might eventually make a mighty combined attack on Syracuse. And Lamachus, the third general, lobbied for an immediate attack on Syracuse while the defenders were still unready. But Lamachus eventually sided with Alcibiades. Unfortunately, fate did not side with Alcibiades. After a brief and mostly fruitless campaign raiding down the coast of Sicily, the Allied fleet received a new ship, freshly arrived from Athens. The ship, named the Salaminia, in memory of the victory at Salamis, had come for Alcibiades. He was wanted for trial in Athens. Alcibiades embarked on his own ship with some trusted companions and accompanied the Salaminia on the journey home, in submission to the will of the people of Athens. Meanwhile, the conduct of the war in Sicily was left to Nicias and Lamachus. Deprived of the funds that the Egestans had seemed to promise, the army now raided wherever they could, and they destroyed the town of Hicra, which was an enemy of Egesta. They made slaves of the captured inhabitants, and shortly thereafter, they sold them all for 120 talents, four times what their new allies had been able to offer. Now, Nicias and Lamachus began to seriously consider how to take the city of Syracuse. Their main concern was avoiding the numerous cavalry of the Syracusans, which the Athenians simply could not match. As always, the Athenian idea was to rely on their strength, which lay in their navy. So they sent a man to the Syracusans, a man pretending to be a double agent, presently with the Athenians, but really on the side of the Syracusans. He told them that the Athenians were camped out at the nearby town of Catana, which the Syracusans already knew, but he also told them the layout of the enemy encampments and where the Athenians kept their arms, and that when the Syracusans came, he and his friends would set fire to the ships of the Athenians and trap them on land as prey for the cavalry of Syracuse. The Syracusans marched excitedly. When they arrived at Catana, however, they found that the Athenians were gone. Every man, every ship. Even as a rider came up from Syracuse bearing the news, the Syracusan leaders realized what had happened. The Athenians had boarded their ships and had landed all their forces directly outside Syracuse and were getting ready to attack. The Syracusan army returned home then as quickly as possible. As they arrived, the Athenians were already landing on the shore of the harbor opposite Syracuse, which sat on a heavily fortified promontory on the eastern side of the harbor. But since the Athenians first paused to fortify a camp, the Syracusans were able to assemble their forces to defend the city. And now each of the two armies waited for the other to make the first move. But the next day, the Athenians and their allied troops suddenly attacked. They split the Syracusan army in two, and the remnants fled, but the Syracusan cavalry, far superior to anything the Athenian forces possessed, prevented the invaders from following the retreating forces into the city, and Syracuse was safe, though shocked by this battlefield loss. It was now early winter, and it did not seem possible to carry on the war, especially as the Athenians recognized they could not defeat the Syracusan cavalry. So they sent messages back to Athens to prepare a cavalry force for shipment to Sicily, and they made plans to recruit their own local cavalry from their Sicilian countryside and to train them. They also sent ships to surrounding nations, even to Carthage, offering alliance and a division of the spoils should they succeed in conquering the island. The Athenians, far from home, were digging in for a long war. The Syracusans were also preparing for a long war. They also sent envoys to the surrounding nations and to Corinth and to Sparta, asking for alliance and assistance. This was not easy to do, sending out these requests, because the Athenian fleet was now trying to blockade the city. Some of these ambassadors, however, managed to reach the Peloponnesian Peninsula. They came at first to Corinth, and then they traveled to Sparta. Here, surely to their surprise, they encountered Alcibiades and his companions, living among the Spartans. As the Athenians had been slipping away from their camp at Catana, you see, to make their surprise attack on Syracuse, Alcibiades had performed his own vanishing act. On their way back to Athens, he and the men sent to retrieve him had stopped at Thurii, a Greek colony in southern Italy. There, Alcibiades had disappeared and become an outlaw. When the Athenian assembly finally learned that he had escaped justice, they passed a sentence of death in absentia, and now Alcibiades had become public enemy Number one, like so many great Athenian men, Alcibiades had ridden the roller coaster of fame and been both hero and villain to the same populace. First, Alcibiades and his friends, now all refugees, crossed the Ionian Sea in a small boat and landed on the Peloponnesus. They had then been promised safe passage to Sparta, and now they were there, offering to help the Spartans and any of their allies to make war on Athens. Alcibiades revealed to the Spartans what was the true grand plans of the Athenian assembly. He said they were not simply helping allies in Sicily. The Athenians wanted to conquer first the island of Sicily, then southern Italy, and then even Carthage. They would then turn the mighty resources of all these lands and peoples against the Peloponnesus, he said, and completely annihilate the Spartans. Alcibiades was also not afraid to address any concerns about trust or his own character either. He admitted that it seemed strange that he would help the Spartans to defeat his own beloved city, especially when he had fought so hard and led troops himself against the Spartans in previous engagements. But eloquent as always, Alcibiades swayed the hard-hearted Spartans. "I do not consider that I am now attacking a country that is still mine," Alcibiades told them. "Rather, I am trying to recover one that is mine no longer. And the true lover of his country is not he who consents to lose it unjustly rather than attack it, but he who longs for it so much that he will do anything to recover it." Alcibiades was not a traitor, you see. He was just a man who was always loyal to himself. His words worked, not only to save his skin, but to energize the Spartans. Alcibiades had urged them in his speech to send troops to aid the Syracusans in Sicily and to renew the war in Attica. The Spartans, who had already been considering an attack on Athens, embraced all these plans. And so the war, running cool now for nearly 7 years, heated to a boil again. The Spartans renewed operations in Attica. In particular, they relied on the little town of Decelea. This place the Spartans held in special regard due to an ancient legend about a hero there. The Spartans had never attacked Decelea during any of their invasions, and now, at the bidding of Alcibiades, they began to fortify it as a base in Attica itself. The Spartans also sent a fleet and a general to Sicily, where the Syracusans gladly accepted Spartan leadership in the war. And suddenly, cities throughout Greece erupted with coups and attempted coups. Revolution was again everywhere. In the summer of that new year of war, the Athenians brought in reinforcements, including plenty of cavalry, to Sicily. They defeated the Syracusans again in the field and now began to build a wall across the isthmus which separated the city of Syracuse from the rest of the island. The plan was that this wall would cut off the city from receiving any aid over land while the Athenian fleet blockaded all the sea approaches. The Syracusans were shocked to see how quickly the Athenians constructed these fortifications. They were still getting their first taste of the Athenian audacity and tenaciousness. There followed a war of wall and counterwall as the Syracusans tried to both stop the Athenians from building their wall while they built their own counterwall perpendicularly to physically block the Athenian wall from reaching the sea. Now, the Syracusans made valiant efforts to stop the Athenians from completing their wall. They even killed the Athenian general Lamachus during one battle in the field and nearly destroyed the main Athenian fort. But in the end, they were driven back, and the Athenian wall continued to march toward the sea. Soon, the city would be cut off by land and embargoed at sea. The Athenians also destroyed the underground pipes that brought water into Syracuse, so they were soon going to be out of fresh water. The leaders of the city began to despair. They even entertained, without actually accepting, offers of surrender terms that came from Nicias, who is now the sole commander of the Athenian army. Then, a ship made it through the Athenian blockade to Syracuse and brought news that a fleet from the Peloponnesus had reached Italy. The Spartans were coming. Mm-hmm. Nicias himself, displaying an unusual lack of wisdom, ignored the Spartan threat. He didn't think the Spartan fleet capable of much more than harassment of his operations at this point, so he continued work on the wall. How the world had changed. The democratic Athenians were now led by a sole commander rather than their usual rotation of command, and the oligarchic Spartans had arrived and formed a confederacy of like-minded nations to defend against the Athenian threat. The Athenians who conquered and laid waste the lands of their enemies, who enslaved and sold their captives. Before the wall reached the sea, however, a Spartan-led army of local allies marched down from out of the north. They were joined by the exhilarated Syracusan forces that now marched out of the city to join them and to confront the Athenians. As the shocked and confused army from Athens tried to prepare for battle, the Spartan leader, named Gylippus, sent an offer across the lines to Nicias. "Agree to pack your belongings and leave Sicily in 5 days," he said, "and then we will consider terms of truce." The Athenians spurned the offer. They continued building the wall. The Spartans, Syracusans, and sundry other allies then advanced to battle. They pushed the Athenians back. They seized one of their fortresses, and they put all the captives inside it to the death. Now, it was the Syracusans' turn to build a wall. They started a counter wall that intercepted the Athenian wall before it could reach the sea. Gylippus, the Spartan commander, hoping to multiply his victory, led his Spartans and Syracusans and others out against the Athenians during the erection of this wall, but they were sorely beaten back. It was too soon to think that the Athenians were completely undone. Still, as he told his men, Gylippus said that they were all Dorians and they should be ashamed if they allowed themselves to be beaten off by, quote, Ionians and islanders and the motley rabble with them, unquote. Battles continued between the two sides, but so did the Syracusan wall. Soon, it was long enough and sturdy enough, and the city was safe from being cut off. Now, both sides began to send out more calls for aid. Both the Spartans and the Athenians went out into the countryside to recruit allies, and both sides also sent envoys back home to Greece to ask for more reinforcements and supplies. Nicias did not pull any punches in the letter that he wrote to the assembly in Athens. In describing how he expected the Spartans to make a combined attack by land and sea against his encamped army in Sicily, he wrote that their ships, the Athenian ships, had rotted in the time that they had spent out at war, and that the crews were wasted by long efforts as well. Quote, "The pristine efficiency of our navy has departed," unquote. The subtext here? "I told you so." The expeditionary army had suffered setbacks about which Nicias had tried to warn the assembly before they put him in charge of it. He emphasized that they were also in danger of being cut off from all resupply in a foreign land, and he got personal with his colleagues in the assembly. "I know that it is in your nature to love to be told the good news first," he said, "and then to blame the messenger if the results do not meet your expectations. Therefore, I thought it best to tell you the truth." Nicias then also asked to be relieved of command, reporting that his kidneys were diseased, but Thucydides does not give us many details about this illness, though we know that Nicias was already sick during battles earlier in the siege. The assembly, when they received this letter, refused the resignation of Nicias and appointed two men to go aid him in his command. One of them was the same Demosthenes who had led the occupation of Pylos earlier in the war. In the meantime, the war in Greece continued on. The Spartans fortified Decelea, the town in Attica that they controlled, and they used it to raid the countryside around Athens and to harass all the supply caravans coming to Athens. Furthermore, some 20,000 slaves, as well as the countless beasts of burden and livestock that they commandeered, would defect to this Spartan stronghold. And the Spartans now sent more Helots, as well as some newly freed Helot soldiers, to Sicily to fight. Again, the strangeness of it all. Slaves running to the Spartans for their freedom, and Spartan slaves fighting against the democracy of Athens. Nevertheless, dire as the situation seemed, the Athenians did not give up. I quote Thucydides here. "Could anyone have imagined, Even when besieged in Attica by the Peloponnesians, instead of withdrawing from Sicily, Thucydides says, the Athenians would continue besieging a town there equal to Athens in size and capability. Thucydides also writes with amazement of the whole endeavor and of Athens, and I quote, "Now, 17 years after the first invasion of Attica, having suffered all the evils of war, going to Sicily to start a new war?" You see, the Athenians would stop at nothing. It was now, after all, a fight for survival. They enlisted the aid of the Thracians, a nearly barbaric people in the far north. These allies came down into Boeotia, into the city of Mycalessus, and sacked all the homes and the temples there. They butchered the inhabitants, young and old, men and women. They assaulted a boys' school, which was in full attendance at the time of the attack, and they massacred all the children. Demosthenes, on his way to assist Nicias in Sicily, stopped the fleet at Kythera and from there attacked the coast of Laconia and fortified an outpost before going on to Sicily. There, in Sicily, the Syracusans were reinventing themselves as the Athenians had done during the Persian War. They put together a fleet and became sailors as well as foot soldiers and horsemen, and they slowly got better at it, losing sea battles at first, but contriving their own methods of fighting on the waves. The Athenians, you see, had become experts at warfare on the open sea and relied on mobility with ships that were lighter in the prow or forward part of the ship. The Syracusans, on the other hand, attacking the Athenians in the confined space of the harbor, built strong, sturdy ships with reinforced prows with which to bash into the Athenian ships and to sink them or board them. Indeed, the Syracusans had already gained a significant victory over the demoralized Athenians in Sicily when Demosthenes suddenly arrived with reinforcements from Athens. 73 more ships carrying 5,000 heavy infantry, and that doesn't include all the light troops, the slingers and the darters and the archers and various support personnel. The Syracusans were clearly dismayed. Here they had felt so certain of victory over the famous Athenians, the global power, but Athens had simply made good its losses with an equally stunning armada of new reinforcements. Now, Demosthenes, arriving in Sicily, didn't want to waste any time. He didn't want to let the Syracusans adjust and prepare and get ready as Nicias had done when he first came to Sicily. He meant to attack right away. After 5 days of preparation, then, the Athenians made an audacious night assault under a bright moon against the Spartans and the Syracusans and their other allies holding the high ground to the northwest of the city. The strong Athenians surprised and scattered the enemy there and rushed ahead to seal the victory. Then, unexpectedly, the Boeotian allies of the Spartans, far from home but longtime enemies of the Athenians, they made a night stand, a stand against the Athenians, and they stopped them. And then suddenly the Athenians broke and they ran. Now, retreats are always bad on an army's morale and its cohesion, but the nighttime and the confusion that came with it made it worse. In the disorder, the Athenians and their allies could not tell if nearby units were friendly or enemy. Crying out their secret watchword to help identify one another only helped the Syracusans and their allies discover the enemy code, and they too began to cry out the watchword, adding to the general confusion. Some of the retreating Athenians fell off cliffs while wandering confusedly in the dark. The Syracusan cavalry tracked other retreating men throughout the night and killed them in the light of the rosy-fingered dawn. So rapidly did the tides turn back and forth. Now the Syracusans were once again glorying in their triumph. Demosthenes, disheartened by this sudden and unexpected disaster, thought that the army should retreat. He thought, in fact, that they should board their ships and leave the country. The losses were great, their wounds were many, and disease was already rife in their ranks. But Nicias, who had never endorsed this adventure, was now committed and would not hear talk of retreat. Thucydides writes that Nicias knew of a party inside the walls of Syracuse that still might be counted on to open the gates, but he also suggests that Nicias did not want to return defeated to Athens and to face the assembly. Some days later, though, new reinforcements arrived from the Peloponnesus, and in full view of the Athenians, whose lingering hopes were now cast down entirely, even Nicias was convinced that it was time to save what they could and return to Athens. There, they could reorganize and defend what they could of the crumbling Athenian Empire. And here, what we would call superstition intervened. The Athenians might have made off. They might have returned safely to Athens and preserved what they could of the empire. They might have sued for peace, perhaps, and retained their lives and their territory and some honor. But at the moment when they were about to embark and sail away in secret, the moon was eclipsed. Now, there was no Pericles here to explain away the occurrence as a natural phenomenon. The men of the army and the fleet were awed by the timing and by the sight of the darkening moonscape on the night sky. All were agreed that they should wait and not set sail under such ominous circumstances. Nicias, in fact, was adamant that they should wait 3 times 9 days, as the soothsayers all advised him. Thus, if they had had a chance, the Athenians missed it. They remained in Sicily, reduced in number, half-starved, weak, diseased. All the while, the Syracusans and the Spartans got stronger. They used the time that they had to practice combat maneuvers in their ships, planning on denying the Athenians any chance to escape the harbor. They eventually attacked on land and by sea. Their combined fleet drove the Athenian ships ashore, and their army drove the Athenian lines even farther back, closer to their main camp. Nicias now held a council of war with his officers, and it was decided to bring the defensive lines back as close to the camp as possible, to defend it with the smallest feasible number of troops, and then to load as many soldiers as they could onto the remaining 110 ships of the fleet and try one last time to drive off the Syracusan and Spartan allied fleet and to secure passage home. The Athenians had been supreme at sea for decades now, and now they were fighting just to escape from a single harbor in Sicily. The next day, they sallied forth, and they were soundly defeated. Some 60 ships remained at the end of the day to the Athenians, and therefore both Demosthenes and Nicias thought that maybe this was enough to attempt one more sea fight. But the Athenian sailors refused to board their ships. They were done. The only option now was to retreat by land to some friendly or semi-friendly town and there to try to arrange passage home for the army, or at least make arrangements for its survival. And so, on the second day after their last sea defeat, the Athenians burned their last few ships and left their camp, marching away, stumbling away, leaving behind the unburied dead and the shrieking wounded, who called for their comrades not to forsake them, and who called to the heavens for mercy. As Thucydides said, they had come to enslave others, and now were departing in fear of being enslaved. The Athenians had no luck. Marching in a hollow square, with the heavy infantry on the perimeter and the baggage carriers and other troops inside the square, the Athenians soon discovered that the Syracusans and the Spartans had blocked all the roads leading away from their encampment. More than once, they managed to pierce the enemy lines and break through, but eventually they were held up at a steep hill, held by a large unit of enemies, with full strength of heavy infantry and cavalry and missile troops. The Athenians, tired, scared, hungry, were repulsed again and again. The Syracusans now came up from behind, and the Athenians suddenly found themselves in truly dire straits. In all this confusion, the elements of the army had become separated. A large unit under Demosthenes was surrounded and offered the chance to surrender. Demosthenes accepted. Later, the portion of the army under Nicias was also surrounded. He, too, surrendered his forces directly to Gylippus, the Spartan commander. Shortly thereafter, a good many Athenians were slaughtered. Nicias and Demosthenes were also executed. Thucydides estimates that a total of no more than 7,000 troops survived the surrender, and were left as prisoners in rock quarries and left there for months as they were slowly sold into slavery, many dying from hunger and disease while they waited. Thucydides finishes his account of the sequence of the war with these words. This was the greatest Hellenic achievement of any in this war, at once most glorious to the victors and most calamitous to the conquered. They were beaten at all points and all together. All that they suffered was great. They were destroyed with a total destruction. Their fleet, their army, everything was destroyed, and few out of the many returned home. Such were the events in Sicily. Somehow this war drags on. The Sicilian expedition ends in disastrous failure in 413 BC, and as you may already know, the war itself does not terminate until 404 BC. In the next episode of this sequence about the Peloponnesian War, we will come to the bloody, agonizing finish of the war that consumed multiple generations of Greeks. Until then, I thank you for listening to the Western Traditions Podcast.